Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's off today. Witches, or those accused of witchcraft, have experienced a long and complicated, often tragic history in this country. Centuries ago, during the era of the notorious Salem witch trials, those thought to be witches were often women, middle-aged or elderly, who survived at the edge of society. Perhaps they experienced misfortune in their homes or livelihoods, or suffered from mental illness. Often they were Christian, as their persecutors were. All were caught up in a terrifying hysteria which gripped the hardscrabble colonies. For the first part of this hour, we'll have a look back across the centuries, and we'll also visit the present day and the emergence of the witch as a figure in feminist pop culture. Catherine Howe is a novelist and editor of the Penguin Book of Witches. Catherine, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Mary.
And as always, the number to call to join the conversation is 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Catherine, if you could, let's begin with the opening of your book, in which you tell a story which reminds us of a largely forgotten place in time, Marblehead, as it was centuries ago.
Yes, happily. Marblehead, Massachusetts is a bedroom community in suburban Boston, a comfortable seaside enclave of historic houses. It has good public schools, intermittent bus service, and a weekly newspaper is read mainly for the juicy names-naming police log. It's not the sort of place where one would expect to find a witch. But a witch did live here, though she's not buried there. Wilmot Red, or sometimes spelled Reed, was one of the more than 100 people who was accused during the Salem witch crisis of 1692. And like the other condemned witches, her body was thrown into a shallow ditch at the base of a rocky ledge to the west of Salem town after being cut down from the gallows. At that time, the area at the foot of the hill where the gallows stood was flooded with brackish water at high tide, and so Wilmot Red, after resting uneasily in the rocky earth of coastal Essex County, was most likely carried out to sea. Today, the ditch she was thrown into is hidden under a pharmacy parking lot.
Do we know why she was accused?
Is there evidence? I don't know much about Wilmot Red specifically, her personally, but generally speaking, and this is true for Salem, but also kind of writ large in the colonial period. Salem was one of many witch trials. It just was the biggest and the most famous. Typically, a woman who was accused as a witch was accused not because of anything that she did. She would be accused because of the kind of person that she was, someone who was difficult, someone who was argumentative, hard to deal with. Perhaps she was economically marginalized. And some historians have argued that actually women were most likely to be accused at middle age. We have this mental image of witches as being kind of bent with and elderly and crone-like. But if you look statistically, typically women were accused when they were in their 40s to their 60s. And so it's when a woman was kind of at what should have been the peak of her social power or her influence. And if a woman was accused, usually it was because something was going on in her life that made her not fit in the social system where she happened to be living.
Yeah. One more note about Wilmot Red. Is there a marker? Is there anything marking her death at that pharmacy parking lot?
Well, actually, you know? There is now. The within like about a year or so ago, after many, many years of kind of going back and forth, people in the Salem area had always known approximately where the hangings had taken place. And for a long time, there was no public marker or recognition of it. And there was some debate back and forth over whether or not should it be a park? Should it be under the auspices of the cemetery department? You know, what are we going to do? And so finally, within the last year or so, a memorial has been erected on the actual site, and you can go visit it today. And it's actually quite beautiful and tasteful.
Catherine, you write, Salem, rather than being an aberration, was instead the most intense and perhaps the most defining expression of North American religious, cultural, and legal thought. Tell us more about that.
Well, I mean, Salem, I think there's a tendency, especially for those of us who learn about Salem for the first time in high school when we read The Crucible, I think there's a tendency to want to think of Salem as this freakish aberration that's hard to understand and explain away. And I think that's one of the reasons that we like to point to this very 20th century idea, this very Freudian idea of hysteria, right? Because that suggests that it is somehow atypical. And the thing that's perhaps creepiest about Salem, for our purposes, is that it was done by the book. It, you know, it followed legal precedent. The people who were engaged in that trial, the people who were accused, the people who were the judges who were adjudicating it, the people who were the theologians who were commenting on it, every one of those people, educated, yeah, thoughtful, reflective people, these were not naive individuals. Just because you're living in the past does not mean that you are a naive person or an uneducated person.
Well, so how did they cross the line and come to believe in witches or witchcraft?
Well, they'd always believed in witches. I mean, witchcraft shows up in the Bible. Yeah. It's the interesting thing about witchcraft, the way that it's talked about in the Bible, is that it's not like listed as a set of practices or a thing that somebody does. It's kind of the oppositional. It is that which we do not do or that which we ought not to do. And so witchcraft in kind of the abstract is an idea that's used to put boundaries around our behavior. So early modern people, so the people living in settling in North America, you know, beginning in the 1620s, 1630s, into the 1690s. So by the Salem takes place in 1692. So we're already a couple of generations into settlement. These early modern people, they live in an intellectual and religious universe that does not question the reality of witchcraft. They don't question the reality of the devil. They don't question the reality of Satan and his ability to influence human affairs. And the other thing that I think is important to remember is, at least for the Puritans who are living in Massachusetts at this time, you know, today we live in a diverse community, mm-hmm, in which we sort of understand that, you know, different religions have different points of view. The Puritans didn't really have this multifarious perspective. They, yeah, believed that there was that which is Christian, which is what they know, and then that which is devilish, which is everything else. Yeah. And so one historian who I admire very much, Mary Beth Norton, has argued that she's a historian at Cornell who works on witchcraft. She's argued that if you look at the language that the Puritans used to describe the devil, it's the same as the language that they used to describe the native population who already lived in the New England area, that there is no distinction in their minds, that which is not Christian, i.e. the native population, is by definition devilish. And you see this in the first kind of written down account of, yeah, Salem. And I love, this is the most American thing ever. Like, a scandal happens and immediately someone writes a best-selling book about it. And that was true in the 1690s as well.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So Cotton Mather, who writes the first published account of Salem, describes, sure, this New England, which was once the devil's territories. And so there's this either-or aspect to it.
How was it actually determined that somebody was, in quotation marks, a witch? What were the determining factors?
Well, there are a couple. There are a couple of bits of evidence that might be entered against you if you're going to be accused as a witch. Only one of which is physical evidence. So one mode of evidence might be spectral evidence. So that's, your neighbor says, "I saw the figure of," pretend like they're talking about me, "I saw the figure of Goody Howe come in at the window, and she told me that she killed our neighbor's sheep." You know, that is called spectral evidence. And one of the big theological debates that took place during Salem was whether or not the devil could assume the shape of an innocent person. Nobody questioned whether or not my shape had appeared. The question was the shape mine because I'd sent it out, or was the shape mine because the devil was assuming my shape even though I was innocent? That was a huge theological debate at that time. So that's one kind of evidence, spectral evidence. The second kind of evidence would be threat followed by maleficium. So pretend like I come to your door, right? And I am always asking for something because I am poor. So I come to your door, you see me coming, and you're like, "Oh man, she's coming back again. I don't have anything to give her today. She's always bothering me. You know, you're hassled. You've got kids that are bugging you. You've got your mother-in-law in the house. You know, it's a busy day." So I come scratching at your door, and you say, "Catherine, get out of here. I don't have anything for you today." And I say, "Well, you're going to regret it if you don't give me something today."
Ah.
Well, you know, I might mean that in a couple of different ways. I might be angry and resentful that you're in a better position of society than I am. Perhaps I mean that you're going to regret it as a Christian. You're going to feel guilty for not doing your duty by me. Who knows what I could mean? But if I go away muttering, and then 10 minutes later, the baby is scalded in your house, you will think about the threat that I made you. So threat
it didn't take much.
It didn't take much. And also, this is a time before the scientific revolution. So we, sure. You know, before there's a common distinction between correlation and causation. So the third kind of evidence that might be entered in against you is physical evidence. And that is, it was widely believed that witches had spirit familiars. So the black cat of stereotypical Halloween representations is a spirit familiar. Spirit familiars, which were devilish imps, which the witch would suckle on her body. So you can see in this conception a perversion of maternal imagery.
It right? is a conception because I'm gathering that most people never observe that. The
no,
accusers.
Well, strangely enough, in the Salem trials, you have testimony of people claiming that they see spirit familiars attending to witches during the examination. So you see, and it's not just cats either. You see discussions of yellow birds that shows up very frequently, things like cats, things like black rats. So it was believed that the witch would suckle a spirit familiar on her body. And so to prove someone was a witch, you might strip her naked and investigate her body for this impish teat. And the most, depending on how, I know it's a little bit early in the day for getting quite explicit, let's just say that by the time your body is naked and you're being searched for telltale marks, you're toast.
Oh, gosh. Well, and did the punishment always end in death?
Well, no, not always, because one thing that's interesting is, at least in the North American colonies, witchcraft was treated like a felony, like murder. So it actually could be kind of hard to prove. It was pretty frequent that someone would be accused as a witch and then acquitted, or there'd be rumors of witchcraft. In fact, one of the ways that we can find evidence of witches in the legal records is to look at slander trials. If someone had a bad reputation for a long time, she might sue for slander in an attempt to clear her name and rehabilitate her reputation. And if you look at Salem, there are a number of people who wind up being accused during Salem who've had bad reputations or sometimes previous accusations and trials for decades. So it was actually a little bit harder than we typically imagine.
No, I was just going to say we're just about up against a break. It's also important to remember that this didn't just happen in Salem. It happened in spots across the country, including in the South. We've got about 20 seconds.
That's true. It was more common in areas settled by Puritans, but witchcraft was against the law throughout the 13 colonies.
Catherine Howe is a novelist and historian. She is the editor of the Penguin Book of Witches, a collection of primary sources on witchcraft in England and North America. We're going to be talking about some of that. Also kind of bring us to the modern era after the break. And then later this hour, we talk about something completely different, a candy called salty licorice. But stay with us. More on witchcraft in just a moment at WHYY. 888-477-9499 is the number to call on this Halloween day. We invite you to stay with us. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty today. We are talking about the history of witches past and present in this country. And we're now going to roll a clip from the TV comedy Broad City, in which the character Abby finds her first gray hair and her friends Bevers and Alana react.
Don't you see? You're becoming a witch, a dope and powerful witch.
Like Dame Judi Dench and Stacey London from What Not to Wear before you. You're ascending.
Witches aren't real, you guys. Dude, if witches aren't real, then who makes all the kombucha?
And where do scarves come from? Scarf tree?
There's people that knit all over the place. You are magical.
It's a swirling chasm of magic.
Well, Catherine, the witch has
that was
long...
awesome.
Oh, goodness. The witch has long been a subjective fascination in pop culture. She or he making a resurgence in particular in feminist pop culture? What's your take?
Well, we start to see the kind of reclamation of witches as a source of power and inspiration beginning around in the 1970s. So witchcraft as a is a modern religion today. There is a modern religion today that is called Wicca, that is witchcraft, that was sort of assembled from a set of folkloric practices and codified beginning in the 1930s. And then in the 1970s, with interest in women's experiences, women's history, and also looking for sources of women's power, there was a real movement among some people to look to Wicca as a sort of feminist spirituality. And one of the things that's really fascinating to me about modern-day Salem, which if you've never visited, you really have to go, and today is the day to be there. It is the biggest Halloween scene you've ever experienced
Sure.
in your life. But modern-day Salem, because so many contemporary witches feel a sense of solidarity with women who were tried as witches in the past, a lot of people have been drawn to settle in the Salem area. So Salem today has a very funky and interesting point of view and vibe.
I've read that there's actually been an increase in interest since the 2016 campaign of Hillary Clinton. I mean,
I've read this as well. In fact, there was recently a couple of headlines that there a group of witches got together in Brooklyn to hex Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, we're going to let that one sit there.
Yeah.
But that the religion is separate. Then it's not Satanism. We're talking about two completely different things.
No,
Wicca
we're talking about. We're talking about different things. Wicca, as it's practiced today, is a form of modern paganism, and it contains practices that have been derived from various strains of folkloric practice, mostly European, although there are various different kind of syncretic approaches to modern-day witchcraft. And so I'm going to kind of leave it at that.
Yeah. But very different than what was perceived back in the days of Salem.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to realize that people who were tried as witches in the early modern period were not tried because they were practicing some kind of secret thing. They were Christian people who were out of step with their society. Now, that's not to say that there wasn't folk magic belief that was in play in that period as well. And in fact, at the very beginning of the Salem Panic, before they'd figured out what was going on, there's a really interesting kind of folk magic moment that happens when one of the first little girls who becomes afflicted during Salem, they take her urine, they mix it with rye meal and bake it into a biscuit, and then they feed the biscuit to a dog. And there are a couple of ways that they thought that this might work. They thought either it would cause the bewitchment to pass out of the little girl and into the dog, or they thought that there might be if a witch was responsible for the girl's affliction, that it might be a way of punishing the witch and forcing her to release the child because of this sense of correspondence.
Hmm.
So one of the common ways of unbewitching a cow, for instance, during this period, was to beat the cow. Because then it was thought that the witch would somehow experience, because of her relationship with the cow, that she herself would experience pain.
Well, we've got phone calls and we've got comments coming in, so we're going to get to those in just a moment. But where did they come up with the methodology? Do you know? Is there evidence?
It's hard to say. There are a number of witch hunting manuals from the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, from both Europe and North America. One of the most notorious witch hunting manuals is called the Malleus Maleficarum, which was not published in English until the 19th century. But a lot of the ideas of who witches are, what they do, and how they can be found out were kind of assembled by theologians at that time period. And so, it's an interesting intersection between like the educated ecclesiastical perspective on witchcraft and where it intersects with the folk perspective on witchcraft.
Let me reintroduce you, Catherine. Catherine Howe is a novelist and historian and editor of the Penguin Book of Witches, a collection of primary sources on witchcraft in England and North America. And again, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Let's get to the phones, shall we? Kyle in Phoenixville is on the line. Hi, Kyle.
Hello.
So what's your question or comment for Catherine?
I just wanted to offer a comment in support of that it didn't always end in death for those people accused of witchcraft. I had an ancestor, Edith Mordecai Crawford, who was put in witch's prison for a year after she was accused of witchcraft when the house burned down that she was kicked out of. The guy who owned the house, accused her of witchcraft, and she was put in prison for a year, and she got out and was actually able to sue him for defamation of character.
Interesting.
That's awesome.
Well, Kyle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And that reminds me, Catherine, you have found in your research that there are people who are either accused witches, or are we calling them actual witches in your family centuries ago? Again, do we know?
Will we ever know? This is true. There are three witches hiding in the family tree. One of them is Elizabeth Howe, which is not a surprise because we have the same last name. And she was a distant great aunt, and she was accused during the Salem Panic, and she was actually put to death. She had had kind of a questionable reputation for a while. She'd put herself forth for full church membership and been rejected. So, you know, we don't know all that much about her personality, but that suggests that there was something that made her unlikable. Another one was Elizabeth Proctor, who was condemned and meant to be put to death, but ended up surviving because she was pregnant, and they were going to wait until she had delivered her child before putting her to death. Thoughtful. But fortunately, by the time she was delivered, the tenor of the trials had changed, and she wound up being having her sentence commuted. And the third one, which was perhaps most, working on witchcraft is going to make you superstitious no matter how rational of a person you are. And this was that experience for me. So my first novel was called The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, and it is a Salem story. And I wrote it around a real person named Deliverance Dane, of whom not much was known. But I picked because I thought her name was cool and very specific to Puritanism and that moment in time. And it
sounded
so metal.
You have to wonder where it came from. Yeah.
Right. And so, lo and behold, what do I find? Years after I've written this novel, that Deliverance Dane was my eighth great grandmother.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So what superstitions have you taken away from your research? What hangs with you to this day, Catherine?
Well, you know, I think a lot of us carry these little superstitions around with us. Like, for instance, today I'm a little nervous. I'm on the radio. I don't do this very often. And to make myself feel better, I'm wearing my grandmother's wedding band.
Really?
And yeah, of course. And we have a name for that in our culture, and that is called an heirloom. And it makes me feel better to have it, and it reminds me of her. But if we're honest, the way I'm treating it is as a talisman, right?
Sure.
I think a lot of us have these kinds of
good luck charms.
Good luck charms are magical thoughts or magical ways of thinking about the world that are held over in ways we don't even recognize.
Back to our questions and comments. Linda says, I've read that accusing a woman of witchcraft was the surest way of depriving unmarried women of their property, often land. Has your guest come across this in her research? Good question.
There was some, it was not so much for unmarried women who typically didn't have property. It was in some instances a way to attempt to claim property from women, perhaps unjustly. And in fact, we see this in one of my favorite witch cases, which actually comes after Salem. It takes place in Virginia with a woman named Grace Sherwood, who is convicted and then later gets out of prison and sues to reclaim her property back from her. But mostly people who were accused as witches weren't going to be property-having people. Most of the time, people who were accused as witches were economically marginalized already.
So, Catherine, to the South, again, for just a moment, were things conducted differently in the South as opposed to the Northeast in terms of the investigation of alleged witches and prosecutions?
They were a bit different, partly because the patterns of settlement were different. So people who settled in Virginia came from a different region in what's now the UK, and they also were Episcopalian largely rather than Puritan, so a slightly different strain of Christianity. And also they lived in a different economic structure. So whereas New England towns were organized around sort of smallish villages is where people lived, obviously Virginia was a plantation system. It was much more spread out. It was a slave economy. And so it was structurally, it was very different. Also, the record keeping is a slightly different. So Grace Sherwood is kind of a fun case because she has a terrible reputation for a very long time. She is finally tried as a witch because, of course, witchcraft has been, you know, against the law. It's been on the books, but there hasn't been a lot of call to use it. So when they try Grace Sherwood, they look up how they should try her. They look it up in a book and discover ducking stools, which, by the way, is not something that we typically used in North America. But Grace Sherwood is ducked.
Well, what is a ducking stool?
A ducking stool is when it was usually used in Britain. It was used for women who were scolds, most typically, which I'm personally very sympathetic with. A ducking stool is basically like a big lever where you make a little chair at the end and you tie someone into it and you dunk them in the water. And so it was also called swimming a witch. And
my
the thing that's fun about Grace Sherwood, though, is that when they ducked her, they didn't know how to interpret the results. They're like, okay, we ducked her. Well, does that mean she's getting out? Now what do we do?
What were they looking for? They didn't know what they were looking for?
They weren't sure if she was supposed to float. Was she supposed to sink? What was supposed to happen? They had no idea. So they end up putting her in prison for a few years. But then she gets out of prison and she goes on to live into her 80s and she reclaims her property. And so this is a moment in time when, you know, we're kind of, witchcraft is receding by the 18th century, is receding away from the legal realm and moving into the realm of the folkloric.
Well, back to England for just a minute, old England. So women who were scolds were subjected to the ducking chair. What does scolds mean in this context?
A scold is a woman who rails. That's a great verb. I think we should bring that back. I mean, it's someone who yells and screams at people and is angry. I mean, they're in our culture today, it is still sharply circumscribed for women to express their anger. Right?
Yeah.
And that was certainly the case in the early modern period as well.
Well, that leads us to a question from Rick. How often were witchcraft accusations based on misogyny?
I mean, that's a hard question to answer because on the one hand, I want to say all the time.
But well, some alleged witches were men as well, but you just don't hear about them.
Well, the thing that's interesting about men who are accused as witches in the early modern period is typically if a man was accused, it was because he was affiliated with a woman who was already accused. So usually married to her. So one of the most infamous men accused during the Salem Panic was Giles Corey, the guy who was crushed between stones, and we all think he gasps more weight at the end, and we don't know if he really said that or not. Giles Corey was accused because he was married to Martha Corey, who was accused first. John Proctor, who is the hero of Arthur Miller's representation of Salem, which is all about John Proctor's moral rectitude. Mm. Well, the real John Proctor was accused because he was married to Elizabeth Proctor, and she was accused first. So there is this sense of witchcraft as almost a contagion, that there is something about being associated with a woman who is suspected as a witch that can be dangerous.
The families
this
could
isn't
be
always
tainted.
True. There's a pretty famous witch named John Godfrey, who was never married and who I talk about in the book a little bit, who is a strange character, but he's definitely the exception to the rule.
Comment from Annabelle and Catherine. I'm not sure you have this at your fingertips. She says, witches come up in the history of beer brewing. When the brewing of beer became profitable, the London Guild kicked women off the job and took it over. They stigmatized the, and I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, alewives, and called the women who kept brewing witches were making poison. That's it.
You know, I feel like I've heard this somewhere. I confess I can't speak to it personally. And I've been under the impression that an alewife was a kind of fish.
Me too. Thank you anyway, Annabelle, for that comment. You also, Catherine Howe, in your book, you take us to Philadelphia in 1787 when accusations again surfaced. You know, this is, I think, as you said, that the witch hunts were dying down or had died down. At around the time, though, of the debate over the Bill of Rights in the Constitutional Convention, a woman named Corbmaker suffers terribly.
Well, this is one of the things that I find so interesting about witchcraft. So the anti-witchcraft statute changes in 1735. The law in England changes so that it's no longer a felony to be a witch. It becomes a crime to present oneself as if one is a witch. So essentially to like offer charms and so forth for a fee. And the thing that I think is interesting about this is that it suggests that belief in witchcraft has not gone anywhere, but it means something different. It is somehow threatening in a different way, or less threatening. But it is true that belief in witchcraft persists. And actually in Philadelphia in 1787, while the Constitutional Convention was meeting, this woman was stoned to death in the street by a mob because she was believed to be a witch. This is the height of Enlightenment rationality and the origin of American democracy. And while it's happening, belief in witchcraft and fear of women who are witches is so profound that mob justice is brought to bear.
Catherine Howe, is there a lesson in the witchcraft hysteria of centuries ago somewhere about the danger inherent, not guarding against paranoia, unsubstantiated thinking that we can apply to modern times?
I mean, I think there's a reason that we as a culture keep working away at Salem, and we keep gnawing at it. We can't let it go. You know, our hunger for Salem stories cannot be sated. And I think part of that is because it forces us as a culture to reckon with how fragile our ideals really are. I mean, because here's a state of affairs where 19 people were put to death by the state legally, following precedent, for a crime that less than a generation later was held to be imaginary. And it was, and so, you know, I think we like to believe that we as a culture value people who are vulnerable, that we are patient with difference and understand difference. And Salem forces us to reckon with how drastically justice can be perverted, even through legal realms, even through legitimate channels. And so I find Salem instructive in thinking about how much we need to fight to hold on to our ideals as they stand.
Catherine Howe, we're going to leave it there. A good way to wrap up this segment. Catherine Howe is a novelist and historian, editor of the Penguin Book of Witches, and you also have a new book coming out next year, The Daughters of Temperance Hobbs. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, and happy Halloween.
You too. Up next on Radio Times, we talk about a deeply strange licorice that Finland just can't quit called Salmiakki. Mark Minnelli has written about it for the New York Times Magazine. We'll talk about that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Keep it here, and thanks for listening. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and on this Halloween day, we're devoting the rest of the show to a type of licorice favored by people who live in Finland. Salmiakki is nothing like the black licorice whip we are used to in this country. Mark Minnelli traveled all the way to Finland to delve into this twist, if you will, in the licorice story. He is a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, and his article is called Salty Tooth, My Journey to the Dark Heart of Salmiakki, the uniquely savory, deeply strange licorice Finland just can't quit. Mark, welcome to Radio Times.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
First of all, are you a licorice fan?
I like classic black licorice. It's not something I eat very often, but as a kid, I always liked it. Salmiakki, though, I should stress, is quite different from the black licorice that you or I are familiar with.
Yeah, we'll get into that in just a second. But first, let's just talk about why licorice, you know, clearly divides people into two camps. Early on in the article, you quote the late Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, who says, our audience is like people who like licorice. Not everybody likes licorice, but people who like licorice really like licorice. You know, what is it about this candy that provokes such a strong reaction? And full disclosure, I am really not a fan. I just don't get it.
Yeah, no, I've actually learned that as I've been working on this piece and just kind of mentioning to friends and acquaintances that I'm working on a licorice story. I've gotten that from many people, that they're not licorice fans, which sort of surprised me. And yeah, I also quote, along with Garcia, I quote in the piece a molecular gastronomist who points out that, you know, if you think about the four, you know, what we consider the four basic tastes, sweet, salty, sour, bitter, licorice, this guy likes to use licorice as an example of a flavor that just kind of doesn't fit in there at all. And it's not really an umami either. It's not exactly sweet. It doesn't fit into those other categories. It's a very, you know, unusual flavor. And, you know, historically licorice root has been used, medicinally, actually.
Sure.
Is it digestive aid? You know, going all the way back to ancient Greek and Indian medical texts, you can find references to licorice. So that's where, you know, it really kind of came out of apothecaries and that sort of realm.
Well, Mark, Salmiakki takes black licorice to a whole new level. Tell us how you ended up going to Finland to investigate this treat, if we can call it that.
Well, Finland is sort of ground zero of this salty licorice. It's really only consumed in a handful of northern European countries, basically. Finland, Iceland, Scandinavian countries, other Scandinavian countries, and I guess the Netherlands and parts of northern Germany. That's pretty much it. But Finland, as I said, is really the home of the most potent forms of it, and it's essentially it's just classic black licorice, but it's flavored with ammonium chloride, which is a salt. But it's not, I know some of your listeners might be thinking, like a sea salt cookie, right? I like sea salt chocolate. But this is not table salt or sea salt. It's this astringent, very bitter salt compound. And it, as I said earlier, it most likely came out of pharmacies originally. Most of the people I talked to over there said it, they would trace it back to like the 1920s, 1930s. You would go to a pharmacy over there and get this licorice and kind of in a powdered form. It would come in like a little envelope, and you would take it, like I said, it's a digestive aid. The combination of the licorice and the salt acts as an expectorant. So that's a, one thought that people have as to why it became popular in these northern European countries. It's so cold up there, and so people.
So they need expectorants.
It's a cold remedy. Yes.
Well, all right.
And then somehow it became a treat that people loved.
Well, look, each culture has its own, particular treats, I'm sure. Let's get to the, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this gentleman's name correctly. Is it Anala?
Anala, yeah. Okay. Jukka Anala.
So he's an editor at the Finnish news agency, STT, who's also written a coffee table book called Salmiakki, and he offers to introduce you to this salty licorice. And again, you're not given a black licorice whip. You are given the powder. Tell us about that and the just kind of the social aspect of consuming this black licorice.
Well, when I got this assignment, I thought I would maybe try to go to Finland in a pure state, not having tried this stuff at all. And then it turned out before I left, a friend had some Dutch salty licorice, which is much milder than Finnish salty licorice. So I did try a piece of Dutch salty licorice, and I have to say I was somewhat underwhelmed. If you go onto YouTube and just search salty licorice, you can find all sorts of reaction videos of kids, American kids generally, being given this licorice and making crazy faces and being, appalled. So I was kind of going into this thinking, maybe it's not quite as bad as it's supposed to be. And when I met up with Jukka, who, as you said, is an author of this Salmiakki book and is also the head of the Finnish Salty Licorice Association. The first salty licorice he laid on me was this powdered form. It's made by a smaller licorice company in Western Finland, kind of a boutique company, and it's a throwback to the powdered pharmacy licorice I was telling you about. So we were sitting in a restaurant, and he said, "Hold out your hand," and he pulled out this jar of a kind of, I would say it looked almost like a powdered cumin or something like that, a brown, very fine powder. And tapped a little bit in my hand, and then said, "Okay, now you lick it."
and you're in the middle of a restaurant. You're not in a room in somebody's house. You're okay.
Yes,
just licking your hand.
Sort of
right.
Classic Finnish restaurant. We just had a delicious meal of fried herring and beets, and so I licked it, and it was very, very intense.
Well, describe that.
Well, you know, the Dutch licorice I'd had earlier, I would say that the salt licorice balance was fairly equal. So it was, you know, it wasn't the, there was enough licorice where the salt wasn't very powerful and it just felt like a slightly savory licorice, but you couldn't really, it didn't overwhelm you in any way. The powder, on the other hand, immediately made my tongue sort of tingle and it very quickly coated my mouth. And it had a very, there was a strong licorice flavor and a very strong ammonium chloride flavor, which, as I said, is not a normal salt. It's quite bitter.
Well, here, Mark, you know what? I've got your quote here from the article. It seemed to intensify the curdled chemical aftertaste, some combination of diet cola, fennel toothpaste, and MSG that multiple sips of water wouldn't flush. I'm sorry, it doesn't sound appealing, but you write that Yuka was lost in a reverie after he consumed his samayaki.
So, oh, he loved it. Yeah.
Well, you know, again, to each his own. I just think it's, you know, it's kind of fascinating. You were, you know, treated to other forms of samayaki. I think you were introduced to a candied heart that was a little bit deceptive, I guess, in the way it looked. And the founder of the company promised you that your wife would be happy with you for 6 weeks if you gave her this candy.
I thought that was a strangely precise amount of time. I was very suspicious of why it was 6 weeks. She turned down my offer of the heart candy. She did try some other salty licorice, but wasn't a fan.
Yes, but summoning up the Finnish concept of something you tell us about in the article, Sisu, you did end up embracing these deceptive candy hearts. Just quickly tell us about that.
Sisu is a Finnish term that means, you know, something like grit or, you know, sort of stoicism, endurance. It's kind of hard to translate, but it's a very, you know, the Finns are very, very proud of this concept of Sisu. And it's, you know, something I came to associate with, you know, surviving a long winter in northern Finland. When it came to the hearts, yeah, I had, you know, in the midst of this long licorice tasting with Yuka and some of his other friends, I, you know, of course I was aware that what I was eating was salty licorice, and I was trying all these different salty licorices. And at one point I just noticed these little reddish hearts and I grabbed one, and psychologically, I guess just because it was a red heart, I just, in my mind, I just sort of assumed it would be slightly sweeter, even though if I had sat down and sort of logically thought about it, I knew I was eating, everything I was eating was salty licorice. It turned out to be one of the most pungent of any of the ones I tasted. So that dissonance was really sort of sent me reeling. And, I guess, you know, when I got home later and thought more about these hearts and the sort of Finnish love of licorice, I thought, you know, I mean, my own assumptions about what this heart should taste like,
sure,
it kind of taken me in that direction. So when I tasted it again, it was still pretty disgusting, I won't lie to you, but it was really not as bad as I'd remembered it. It was no worse, you know, than any of the others. So that was a kind of interesting little mini revelation.
Well, again, all joking aside, I mean, this is a beloved treat in Finland and some of the other countries, Sweden, Norway, the Netherlands. Again, what do you think the appeal is at the heart of all this? No pun intended.
I guess, you know, I think with all candies, you know, across any culture, I'm sure so much of it is associated with, you know, what you ate growing up with. There's a very nostalgic aspect, I think, to candy. It's such a sort of primal thing, and it's such a comfort food. So, you know, if you're given this stuff from a very early age, I would imagine you associate it with all sorts of happy memories.
Sure.
So that's my thinking, and you know, and it is wild to go into, you know, any kind of just corner convenience store in Helsinki, and they have lots of candy overall. They're the top per capita consumers of candy, or no, sorry, the number five per capita consumers of candy in the world. U.S. doesn't even make the top 10.
Oh, that's interesting.
And in these stores, you'll see an entire rack, generally, of salty licorice, which is just really fascinating.
Hey, Mark. So at one point, you ponder whether salmiakki will end up like other regional delicacies in different areas of the world, which, Nashville hot chicken, East Harlem chopped cheese sandwiches. In a way, there's almost kind of like a spoiling of the effect if it just becomes too mass produced. Do you think that's going to happen with salmiakki?
I don't think there's a danger of that happening. I put the question to the marketing director of Fazer, which is the big, they're sort of the Hershey's of Finland. They're the biggest chocolate and candy producer, the biggest licorice producer by far. They make something like 3,000 tons of salty licorice every year. And they're actually planning on trying to make some inroads into the U.S. with chocolate next year. They're putting out a sort of premium line of chocolate bars called Nordy. And so I asked the guy, what about salty licorice? And he just smiled and said, they'd had their sort of taste experts in the U.S. try various salty licorices, and they found them interesting, just the way he phrased it.
Thanks, but no thanks. Hey, we've got I'm sorry to keep jumping in on you. We're very close to the top of the show. I did want to get these comments in. Tweet from Rini, who says, my aunt worked in a licorice factory in Philly in the 50s and early 60s. She used to bring home very strange flavors of licorice, including mint and lime. Then a question from Alex. Why do you think Americans tend to flavor their licorice with strawberry or cherry? Is what we call licorice even licorice? I know you've got some thoughts on that.
Right. Well, red Twizzlers are, by far our most popular licorice. I'm making air quotes here. You can't see me. Because actually, your listener's right. It's not, red Twizzlers are not licorice flavored. They're strawberry flavored. There's no licorice extract in Twizzlers, that flavor of Twizzler. And, I guess they have a vague sort of licorice-y consistency and shape. I'm not sure. Americans in general, I think our general consumption of even just sort of straight black licorice is fairly low compared to other countries. It's just not one of our favorite treats over here.
Mark Minnelli, Finns are apparently happy people. Any connection that you can see? Didn't they got the top spot on the 2018 World Happiness Report?
I facetiously, pointed out, somewhat facetiously pointed out that correlation. Finns, the UN did this happiness study. Finns were number one. Norway, Iceland, Denmark, all also salty licorice companies were in the top 10. We were way down at number 18 with our giant Snickers bar. So you can draw your own conclusions from that.
Well, Mark Minnelli, what a treat, a tutorial on salmiakki. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark is a contributor to the New York Times Magazine. And as always, that about wraps it up for this edition of Radio Times. Don't forget to check out Radio Times on social media. Listen to our podcast, whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. You're listening to This is Halloween on Radio Times from the film The Nightmare Before Christmas, composed by Danny Elfman. Happy Halloween.
Boys and girls of every age.